The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Thanks to Richard Palmer for filling in on yesterday's program. I had some early morning lectures to finish off with here at the early part of the semester for Armstrong College. And we have a lot to get to today. I'd actually like to go back to, I know I commented a fair bit on Monday's program about the G7 meetings over the weekend. And President Trump had a press conference on Monday after we had our broadcast. So I'd like to return back to that, just a couple of interesting statements that he made that we'll expand upon a little bit later on in this segment. Also coming up on today's program, I'll talk in the second segment about how important it is for us to be positive and thankful and grateful. I've talked about this before on the program, but it's certainly a good reminder, as it certainly is easy in this world to get very negative and even discouraged. So we'll have some very encouraging scriptures to look at coming up in the second segment. Well, the UK is in the midst of a constitutional crisis. It's being led by a dictator. He's hijacked the government. He's taken over. And now he's ruining that nation. That, according to the radical left, it's a similar storyline as what you often hear in the United States. This morning, the UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson, he said that he plans to recommend that the Queen prorogue Parliament. That means to discontinue Parliament for a time, I think for about a month or so. But the timing is what has so many of his opponents up in arms. He's recommending that Parliament be disbanded for a month, starting on September 10th and continuing on through to October 14th. Now, Richard tells me from our Ed Stone offices that this type of thing is pretty normal. It's standard procedure. It happens generally about once a year. And then the Parliament regroups. You have similar recesses, I suppose, in the U.S. As well. But it's very controversial now because of Brexit, because there's people in the U.K., there's people in Parliament that simply will not accept the fact that the British people voted to move out of the European Union. They won't accept it. They're doing anything that they can to stop it, to delay it. And so here comes Boris Johnson and says, hey, I'm going to recommend to the Queen that we prorogue Parliament for a month right before the Brexit deadline. And so the left, they're going crazy in the UK. Richard gave me some of the history with these recesses. It happens a lot. There's nothing unusual about it. There's certainly nothing illegal about it. Parliament hasn't been ignored. They had their say. They've had their votes on Brexit, even over and again under Theresa May's government. And every single time, the will of the people has won out. But now with Boris Johnson recommending this, well, it's just unleashed a storm of outrage. Stop the coup. That's trending on Twitter. Stop the coup. The Boris Johnson coup. Labour politician, Lord Adonis, he calls this a constitutional crisis. Author Philip Pullman tweeted that the prime minister has finally come out as a dictator. He's a dictator because he's trying to do what 17 million people voted for. One liberal Democrat, he tweeted, Johnson is behaving like a tin-pot dictator. So all of the anti-Brexiteers, they're not giving up. They're not going down without a fight. Some of them have already started off with a court case trying to say that this is illegal, that Prime Minister Johnson can't do this. And, of course, Parliament, as I say, they're looking for any and every way that they can to stop the will of the people. It is interesting to just consider the parallels. Brad McDonald was noting this earlier today as well. The parallels between the United Kingdom and the United States and the radical left, or the deep state, if you want to call it that. These entrenched bureaucrats who think that they know better than the people. Well, we've seen what they've done in the United States and how strong the opposition has been against President Trump. And it's the same. There's some similar parallels, as I say, with what's happening now in the UK. It's a constitutional crisis because of Brexit, or it's a constitutional crisis in the U.S. because of Donald Trump. I mentioned previously this comment made by Piers Morgan. He's a right-wing conservative. He had a show on CNN for some time and then has since gone back to the UK, and he hosts one of the morning shows there on TV. And he has a pretty good relationship with Donald Trump. I think he's come to his defense on a few occasions. But listen to what he says about just the press coverage, their focus. This was on the Ben Shapiro show just a week or two ago. Here's Piers Morgan, clip 3.
So as the media, I think you have an option, the collective media. Do we spend all day attacking this guy, hoping that he reacts? Is that really in the best interest of how we cover this presidency, given that's what we know he's like? And I think at the moment, it's like they're in an abused relationship, the media and Trump. And it's ugly. And I don't think it works for the American people. I think too much important stuff is getting forgotten about. You know, every day, the only story is Trump. Every newspaper front page, every news bulletin, every cable news show, it's just Trump, 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 Trump. Other things are happening in the world. You know, we have the same thing in Britain with Brexit. It becomes all pervasive, all dominant. It sucks the life out of everything else.
That's Piers Morgan from a couple of weeks ago, pointing out the obvious, that there are other things going on in this world. If every day it's about Trump, Trump, Trump in the United States, or Brexit, 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 Johnson, Johnson, Johnson in the UK, think about all of the topics, the events, the prophetic events that are being ignored. There's a short piece in Spiegel today about how that Germany shouldn't be complacent anymore. It's time for Germany to step up. We've been pointing to these articles for some time now. Spiegel says the days in which Germany can afford to be complacent are over. Europe's largest economy needs to finally accept that it's too big and important to simply sit on the sidelines. It needs to invest, innovate, and above all, lead. Germany needs to lead. This article talks about Angela Merkel, and really it points to her weaknesses, her passionless politics, and how that Germany needs to rediscover its political passion. Well, what do we know about the history of Germany, the recent history of Germany's political passion? We're going to talk on Friday's program about the 80th anniversary of the start of World War II. Back then, Germany was led by a very passionate political movement. This article says another problem is that Germany still doesn't see itself as a global power with all the responsibility that comes with such stature. This too needs to change. This needs to change. Germany needs to see itself as a global power. Germany needs a creative drive to help it carve out a role for itself in the world, both politically and economically. To that end, Germany must accept that it is simply too big to be like Switzerland. It can't simply stay silent when France's president pitches the idea of working with Germany to reform the EU. That, as you step back, is what we're seeing. And it's starting with Brexit. Okay, the UK is obsessed with Brexit. Well, let's talk about the significance of this. Leaving aside the fact that Mr. Armstrong said it would happen, that's pretty significant too, but this is bringing about the EU reform. That too is prophesied, because we know the Bible says that there's 10 of them. 10 nations. And so it's time for Germany to step up and to lead. It's not Switzerland. It has to be a dominant global power. That's what they're calling for. That's what they're calling for within Germany. That's what other nations are calling for. That's what the United States even wants. The French president, Macron, he recently called for Europe to reach out to Russia. That's going on. Of course, that's significant when you look at the history. Even that leading up to World War II, that pact between Germany and Russia. It's interesting, by the way, Macron can call for that. Other leaders in Europe can call for that. Strengthening ties with Russia. But if President Trump ever even hints at it, well, he's obviously a puppet of Vladimir Putin's. Another region that's being overlooked right now is the Middle East. And the war, that's what Jonathan Speier is calling it, the war between Israel and Iran. Jonathan Speier, we have met with him before. He knows Brent, our correspondent over there in Jerusalem, and I've chatted with him a time or two over the years. This is from a column in the Wall Street Journal. Speier says Israel and Iran are at war. Israeli strikes this week in southern Syria, western Iraq, and eastern Lebanon, and possibly even Beirut confirm it. Have you heard anything about this from the major media? Are they concerned about this at all? These tensions in the Middle East? The significance of these tensions? Of course, Israel probably feels like it has a freer hand because it has the support of the United States, this presidency. More so than it did under Obama, that's for sure. Speier says, this is a 21st century affair. For now, it involves only small circles among the Israeli and Iranian populations. Parts of the Air Force, intelligence services, and probably special forces are active on the Israeli side. And then the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, its expeditionary Quds Force, and proxy political. So it just talks about all the groups that are going at it. Proxies, for the most part. It says the war marks a hinge point in Middle Eastern geopolitics. For the past decade and a half, the region has been engaged mainly with internal strife, civil wars, insurgencies, and mass protests. These are now largely spent, leaving a broken landscape along the northern route from Iran to Israel. And as Speier brings out later on, the one who's benefited from this broken landscape, above all, is Iran. Just like we said all along, Iraq was going to fall to Iran. You look at all of the turmoil, the civil war in Syria that went on for years. And you throw Lebanon into the mix. Speier says Iran treats this entire area, that's Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon, as a single operational space, moving its assets around at will, without excessive concern for the national sovereignty of the governments in Baghdad, Beirut, and Damascus. So basically, Iran just has a free hand to move through all of these states, all of these nations. We've talked about this corridor that it's worked to build all the way through to the Mediterranean Sea. And Israel's finally decided, well, if they have a free hand in Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon, then we have the right to attack some of their strategic targets in those nations. And that's what they're doing. It says Israeli attacks in recent days suggest that Israel, too, has begun to act according to these definitions and in response to them. If Iran will not restrict its actions to Syria, neither will Israel. There's a crucial difference, it says, between Israeli and Iranian positions in this conflict. Iran's involvement in Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon is deep, long-term, and proactive. They're looking at it for the longer term, establishing a permanent presence. Their involvement there with the militias in Iraq and elsewhere, their involvement there is deep and proactive. And Israel, of course, is concerned with it's concerned about its self-defense, its security. It's a pretty rough neighborhood that Israel's in. Speier concludes here, saying, so it is war between Israel and Iran, prosecuted over the ruins of Iraq, Lebanon, and Syria, but it won't necessarily stay that way. A single kinetic and successful Iranian response to Israel's airstrikes could rapidly precipitate an escalation to a much broader contest. State-to-state conflict has returned to the Middle East. A great piece there by Jonathan Speier at the Wall Street Journal, I believe, just yesterday. That's a region that's being overlooked. Certainly a lot of Europe is being overlooked as well. Well, regarding those, I guess you could say, leftovers from the G7, Donald Trump had a press conference on Monday. And as he often does, he stood out there for quite some time taking a lot of questions. He's very accessible, more so than the previous president, by far. He's out there taking questions, and in the case of hostile reporters, he's firing back. This first exchange here, this is a reporter that brought up some of the history from 2014, Russia's annexation of Crimea, and she brings out that the president, President Trump, has said that Vladimir Putin outsmarted Barack Obama. He just waltzed right in there and took over Crimea. And this reporter, who loves Barack Obama, she rose in defense of the previous president. And here's how that exchange went down. This is clip one.
And I say, how does that work?
Misleading statement that Russia outsmarted President Obama.
Well, he did.
When other countries have said that the reason why Russia was kicked out was very clearly because they annexed Crimea. Why keep repeating what some people would see as a clear lie?
Well, it was annexed during President... I know you like President Obama, but it was annexed during President Obama's term. If it was annexed during my term, I'd say, sorry, folks, I made a mistake, or sorry, folks. President Obama was helping Ukraine. Crimea was annexed during his term. Now, it's a very big area, very important area. Russia has its submarine. That's where they do their submarine work, and that's where they dock large and powerful submarines, but not as powerful as ours and not as large as ours. But they have their submarines. And President Obama was pure and simply outsmarted. They took Crimea during his term. That was not a good thing. It could have been stopped. Could have been stopped.
That's President Trump on Monday saying it could have been stopped. It could have been stopped by America's larger submarines. But they don't like that. The radical leftists in the news media, they don't like it. When anyone criticizes Barack Obama, he was their messiah. But go back and look at the history. We're talking about something that happened 5 years ago. 5 years ago. We wrote at the time, this is from Jeremiah Jacques at the Trumpet, here's what Putin didn't do in Crimea. He didn't march battalions of clearly marked Red Army troops onto the peninsula, brandishing the Russian tricolor and singing God Save the Tsar. He didn't say that Moscow utterly rejects the Western-made systems of law, morality, and ethics and have steered international geopolitics almost unchallenged since the demise of the Soviet Union. He didn't hoist the Russian flag in downtown Simferopol without consulting local authorities and citizens. Jeremiah says those kinds of moves would have been more like the kicks and punches of a geopolitical kickboxer or a karate guru. Putin is a judo man, he says. So after deploying undercover agents to destabilize Crimea, he held a referendum to decide whether the people of the peninsula wanted to return to Mother Russia. He basically said, give the people a voice. Let the individuals most affected make this weighty decision. Let not my will, but theirs be done. This is from the Trumpet in 2014. Jeremiah says after the vote, Putin even spouted off a line that could have come straight out of Hillary Clinton's press conference. It was in full accordance with democratic procedures and international legal norms. That's what Putin said in 2014. Look, we gave him a referendum. The people have spoken. Jeremiah says, of course, the truth is that Ukrainian law unambiguously forbids any such referendum. Its constitution explicitly states that Crimea is an inseparable constituent part of Ukraine, and its laws are subservient to those of the central government in Kiev. But the people spoke. The people spoke, and Putin did point this out. This was how President Obama at the time, this was how he reacted to Russia seizing control of Crimea and then, of course, putting up this sham of a referendum. This is clip four.
In recent months, as the citizens of Ukraine have made their voices heard, we have been guided by a fundamental principle. The future of Ukraine must be decided by the people of Ukraine. That means Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity must be respected, and international law must be upheld. And so Russia's decision to send troops into Crimea has rightly drawn global condemnation. From the start, the United States has mobilized the international community in support of Ukraine to isolate Russia for its actions and to reassure our allies and partners. We saw this international unity again over the weekend, when Russia stood alone in the UN Security Council defending its actions in Crimea. And as I told President Putin yesterday, the referendum in Crimea was a clear violation of Ukrainian constitutions.
That's how Barack Obama responded to Vladimir Putin carving up Ukraine. Obama said, listen, the will of the Ukrainian people, that has to be respected. This violates their constitution and such. The problem is, he had spent the better part of his presidency encouraging these uprisings. He did it in Egypt. He did it with South Sudan, as Jeremiah points out in his article. In January of 2011, this was under Obama's watch, they had a referendum that resulted in the establishment of South Sudan. South Sudan broke away from Sudan, and President Obama called it an inspiration to the world and a tribute to the determination of the people and leaders of South Sudan to forge a better future. Well, Vladimir Putin seeing all this happen right in front of his eyes, South Sudan, the uprisings across the Middle East in 2011 and beyond. And so he sends in his agents. He sends them into Crimea. They put up this referendum under the threat of violence, of course. They have the vote. The vote is overwhelmingly in favor of Crimea moving along or breaking away from Ukraine to return to Mother Russia. And then Vladimir Putin comes out and says, well, hey, we gave the people a voice. Jeremiah says this, the Sudanese vote was more internationally legitimate than that in Crimea, but the recent history still puts a serious judo leg lock on America's ability to criticize Crimea for wanting to forge a better future for itself. See, like he says, if you say, well, this is a great idea for South Sudan, you don't really have much leverage against Vladimir Putin when he comes along and says, this is a great idea for Crimea. The referendum in Crimea, regardless of how unfairly it was actually conducted, allows Mr. Putin to say he remained within the boundaries of international law and that he let the power of the people prevail. He used the West's weight against it in something like a standard judo large wheel throw. And as Jeremiah brings out, the examples could go on. They could go on. Putin used the West's weight against itself. He outsmarted us. He certainly outsmarted Obama. But if you're in the left-wing media, that is forbidden, any kind of criticism aimed at Barack Obama. That's against the rules. This is Joe Scarborough's reaction to the president's comments from Monday, clip 5.
But President Obama was unable to stop it.
It's insanity.
Yes, it
First
is.
Of all, Vladimir Putin did not take Crimea from an American president. Vladimir Putin took Crimea from Ukraine, just like he took Georgia from Georgia. Those invasions were invasions of Vladimir Putin, a man who is still trying to disrupt and interfere with American democracy, according.
So you get the last statement there. First, Obama can't be blamed for anything Vladimir Putin did from 2009 to 2016. Nothing. Nothing. And then he says there at the end, here is this guy. He's still meddling in our elections. And President Trump, the implication being that President Trump is not only not doing anything about it, he's part of the problem. He's working in cahoots with Putin. They still believe this. They still believe it. And even with respect to Russian meddling, you know all about what Barack Obama was not doing in the last few years of his presidency, even as his intelligence agents were saying, look, they're trying to interfere with elections. Look at what they did in Crimea in 2014. And then when his intelligence advisors are coming to him in 2016 saying that, you know, you better watch, he's trying to tamper with U.S. elections. What did Barack Obama say? What did he say in October of 2016? He said no serious person could suggest that our election would ever be rigged. Here's what he said, clip 6.
There is no serious person out there who would suggest somehow that you could even rig America's elections. There's no evidence that that has happened in the past or that there are instances in which that will happen this time.
That was a position before the election because they all knew Hillary Clinton was going to win. And then after Donald Trump shocked the world, well, it's been Russia, 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 Russia. And a number of other things as well. Victor Davis Hanson had a column at American Greatness, the mythical Trump Hydra. Russia, Russia, Russia. Trump is a Russian asset, they say. He ran, as VDH says, he ran for president only to enhance his partnership with Vladimir Putin. He did this in order to strengthen the ties with Vladimir Putin. Victor Davis Hanson says, in reality, and in contrast with the Obama administration, Donald Trump slapped tougher sanctions on Putin's circle, pumped far more U.S. oil and gas that helped lower world energy prices to Putin's chagrin, killed scores of Russian mercenaries in Syria, beefed up the U.S. military, jawboned NATO into spending more on collective defense against Russia while withdrawing from asymmetrical short-range missile treaties with the Kremlin due to Russian cheating. All the former and current federal officials who peddled the collusion and obstruction mythologies eventually were rendered as incompetent partisans who dishonestly promulgated fantasies at best and outright lies at worst. And he lists them all off by name. These Obama officials peddling lies. They don't like it when President Trump comes along and points out an obvious truth, a painful truth the way they see it. This is what President Trump said in an interview about Russia and the previous administration, not that long ago, clip 7.
But look at the sanctions I've put on. Look at the diplomats I threw out. Look at all of the things that I've done. Nobody else did what I've done. Obama didn't do it. Obama was a patsy for Russia. He was a total patsy. Look at the statement he made where he thought the mics were turned off, okay? The stupid statement he made. Nobody does a big deal about that. Getting along with President Putin, getting along with Russia is a positive, not a negative. Right. Now, with that being said, if that doesn't work out, I'll be the worst enemy he's ever had. The worst he's ever had.
The worst, I'll be the worst enemy Putin's ever had. Some hyperbole there, but still pointing out what he did about Obama, leaning when he thought the mic was off, leaning over to Medvedev, saying, you know, when I get reelected, I'll have a lot more flexibility with you and Vladimir. Can you pass this along to Vladimir? That's history. That's recent history. But they won't look at the facts. They just go right on peddling the lies, as Victor Davis Hanson says. There was an exchange on Monday, too, about the president. I guess he wants to, the next time the G7 meets, he wants for it to be at his resort in Doral, Florida. And so, of course, a reporter says, well, how can you assure the American people you're not doing this to just line your own pockets? And Victor Davis Hanson brings that out in his article as well. This myth that, well, Donald Trump, he never really wanted to be president in the first place. He just wanted to enhance his brand. In reality, says Hanson, the Trump empire reportedly has declined by nearly $1 billion in net value, aside from the tens of millions of his own money that Trump spent on the 2016 campaign. Trump's business interests are the most thoroughly investigated of any recent president in memory. Obama and the Clintons made millions from their presidencies. Trump may well end up losing billions. How about that? Well, here's that exchange with the reporter on Monday, clip 2.
China, and on next year's G7. You alluded today, dropped several hints about Miami, about Doral, and hosting next year's G7 at your property. What reassurances, if any, can you give the American people that you are not looking to profit off the presidency?
Well, I'll tell you what, I've spent, and I think I will, in a combination of loss and opportunity, probably it'll cost me anywhere from $3 to $5 billion to be president. And the only thing I care about is this country. Couldn't care less, otherwise I wouldn't have done it. People have asked me, what do you think it costs? And between opportunity, not doing things, I used to get a lot of money to make speeches. Now I give speeches all the time. You know what I get? Zippo, and that's good. And I did a lot of great jobs and great deals that I don't do anymore, and I don't want to do them because the deals I'm making are great deals for the country, and that's to me much more important.
That's President Trump on Monday saying that, look, I'm not profiting. I'm losing money, actually. Pretty amazing response. He's not going to get any leeway from these reporters. Everything that he does, it's suspicious. It's for his own businesses. Victor Davis Hanson, as I say, he lays it out. All these myths. The fact that he's profiting, the fact that he's a Russian asset. He's unhinged. He's mentally deranged. We went through this on Monday. That crazy clip. Saying that he was responsible or could be responsible for more deaths than Mao, Putin, and Hitler combined. Hanson says, in reality, Trump easily aced the Montreal Cognitive Assessment, which calibrates pre-dementia, administered by his presidential physician, a test that Joe Biden, presidential aspirant, might have a far greater difficulty passing. Hanson says, in terms of age, Trump seems far more vigorous than most men at 73 and downright youthful compared to a faltering and often confused and addled 76-year-old Biden. Trump's able to speak extemporaneously for extended periods of time while holding the attention of an audience of thousands. No one seriously believed that talk of removal through the 25th Amendment was anything other than a last-ditch effort to remove Trump from office after the failure of impeachment proceedings and the Mueller investigation. Well, he continues, Victor Davis Hanson does, with all of these myths, Trump's a racist, he's a white supremacist, he's an incompetent buffoon, he's a loser, there's no way he can win. He gives all the quotes from 2016, Obama, Hillary, and others, all the commentators, all the ones that are coming forward now saying there's no way he can win in 2020. There's no way this can happen. And he just continues to prove people wrong. He continues to expose these myths. Over and again, they get it wrong, his critics, his opponents. Over and over and over again, they've been proved wrong. Now, that's not to say everything that this president does is right. But it certainly is. When you look at what Bible prophecy says about the last two administrations in the United States, there certainly are some riveting detail brought out in Scripture about what is to happen in our nations, the United States and Britain, just before the Great Tribulation sets in, tribulation prophesied in Matthew 24 by Jesus himself, tribulation that leads right into the return of Jesus Christ to this earth. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
The human mind is a wonder. It can produce marvelous developments in science and technology. But the stark record of history shows the same mind cannot solve problems like war, illiteracy, poverty, starvation. The rapid advancements have not advanced world peace and have not prevented the evils that ravage our modern world. Mankind has proven tremendous at working with matter. Yet, history and events currently at play show man a devastating failure working with his neighbor. These truths raise many vital questions. What is human nature? Where did it come from? Did God create evil in man? And why has the mind of man produced such incredible advancement on the one hand, and on the other has not prevented calamitous evils? The answers are revealed clearly in the Holy Bible. Do you know what it says? There is no denying that our time has become fiercely evil. Is it even possible to escape the clutch of these seemingly unsolvable problems? For the remarkable answer, request our free booklet, Human Nature, What Is It? From thetrumpet.com.
The Trumpet Daily.
In listening to Joel Hilliker's lecture earlier this week on Winston Churchill and some history regarding his family, his upbringing, his ancestors, he made the point that when Churchill was researching into the life of his famous ancestor, the Duke of Marlborough, that he considered all the positives and the negatives together in his research, and then concluded that this famous leader, this famous warrior, saved Britain, preserved freedom in Europe, freedom from a tyrant, Louis XIV, I think it was. But Mr. Hilliker was making the point that Churchill really did have a positive view of history. It's not that he ignored the negatives, but he did have a positive focus, and you see that too when you read his other histories, the history of the English-speaking peoples. You see that when he wrote about or spoke about the British Empire. It wasn't perfect, but it exported a lot of positives to the world. Law and order, educational systems, freedoms, all kinds of things. A positive view of history. My father makes this point, I think it's in the Chronicles booklet, about how Ezra, when he came back and wrote the history surrounding the throne of David, he focused on King David, and even though the Bible certainly does have sections about David's sins and the mistakes that he made, he said that Ezra concluded the story by focusing on the positives because David repented. David became a man after God's own heart. How important is it for us to maintain a positive, hopeful, even grateful and thankful attitude or outlook? It says in Romans 1 and verse 21, because that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. When they knew God, they didn't glorify him as God, and they weren't thankful, it says. They weren't thankful. We've been going through the Garden of Eden and Adam and Eve and the discussion they had with the serpent in chapter 3, Eve and the serpent, or the devil. And there were obviously, he came along and appealed to their vanity and told them that they can decide for themselves what's right and wrong. They didn't need God to tell them. Satan lied and said, you already have an immortal soul. You're going to live forever. He lied to them and they believed it. And God cut them off from the tree of life. That's all in Genesis 3. And you can key in on a number of factors, I suppose, as to why they did what they did. But as I was telling the students yesterday in a forum, how ungrateful for Adam and Eve, their maker, bringing them into existence, equipping them with this human spirit, not an immortal spirit, but a human spirit that allowed for them to think and to reason like God, even. It was a godly type mind. quite unlike what you see in the rest of the Nefesh creations. The animals, I mean. They don't have mind power. They can't think and reason. They can't appreciate fine culture. They don't go to a concert and say, that was the best I've ever heard. They have none of that because they don't have a mind. God equipped us with a mind. So he puts, and besides that, here there are these perfect physical specimens. This is 6,000 years ago, so they're in perfect health. They have each other. They have companionship. They're about to build a family. They're in this glorious Garden of Eden. And God says, don't take from this tree, but here's the tree of life. And if you take of this tree, your human spirit can actually combine with my Holy Spirit. And then you can develop the divine nature. And that can lead to eternal life. Satan comes along and says, you don't need God and you already have eternal life. You decide what's right and wrong. And they went along the devil's course. How ungrateful, how unthankful, after all that God had given them, all of that personalized instruction, that revelation. He gave them everything they needed to know to be a success. And they rejected it and chose instead to eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And man's been partaking of that tree ever since. We've been cut off from the tree of life. That's clear at the end of Genesis 3. The realization of what that meant, what that did to this world, that's what impelled Mr. Armstrong to write Mystery of the Ages. Well, I could go on about that foundational beginning, but to just focus on this point about being thankful and grateful, look at what's prophesied in 2 Timothy 3, verses 1 and 2, where it talks about the last days. Perilous times shall come, dangerous times are here. It says, for men shall be lovers of their own selves, covetous, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy. Unthankful. Mr. Armstrong said one of the most common sins, even among God's people, has always been griping, complaining, called murmuring in the Bible. This attitude of criticizing, finding fault, grumbling is negative, unspiritual, and is a disease that produces unhappiness and loss of faith in the perpetrator and great annoyance to others who hear it. The cure, listen to this, the cure is to set your mind in the opposite mood, that of gratitude. He says perhaps the most common sin in professing Christians is ingratitude, failure to be thankful, to count one's blessings. So the cure, the solution, is to set your mind in the opposite mood of being thankful and grateful. We have a part to play in this. Of course, God will help us as he fills us with his spirit, with his mind. But we've got to set our minds in that direction. Philippians 4:8, whatever things are lovely and honest and true, and all through the list there in that verse, that wonderful verse. Paul says, think on these things and do them. Colossians 3 and verse 15, listen to this one verse. It says, and let the peace of God rule in your hearts, to the which also you are called in one body, and be you thankful. Be thankful for all that God has given to you. Even in times of trial and test, be thankful. Mr. Armstrong wrote about his son and that tragic car accident that he got into in the late 1950s, I think it was. He broke all these bones in his body. I think he lived for a few days after the car accident. and he was in the hospital. This was a 29-year-old man who had just been married, recently married. He was a newlywed, and they had a little infant, a little baby, a few months old. A 29-year-old, recently married, with a little baby boy at home. And he gets into this catastrophic car accident. And he's in the hospital for the remaining days that he's alive. He's in the hospital recounting all of the blessings that God had given to him. Now, that's quite an attitude coming from a young person who is about to die prematurely. And he gave God thanks because he knew he had been blessed. 1 Thessalonians 5:18. It says, "In everything give thanks, for this is the will of God in Christ Jesus concerning you." In everything give thanks. Do you give God thanks in everything? Are you quick to go to God and say thank you when you know he's intervened on your behalf, or he's answered your prayer, or he's helped you out in time of need? Mr. Armstrong, he once wrote the headquarters staff. This is from 1961. He said, "Do you just take all these good things for granted, unconcerned? It's time all of us realized how blessed we are and give God thanks." That's Mr. Armstrong writing to the headquarters employees who evidently maybe weren't as grateful as they should have been. It's time all of us realize how blessed we are and give God thanks. Let's be grateful, he said. He went on to say one of the greatest and commonest sins is ingratitude. Don't be guilty of it, he said. Give God thanks in everything. Realize how blessed we are. Be grateful. Ephesians 5:20 says, giving thanks always for all things unto God and the Father in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. Giving thanks always for all things. It's possible, even in the midst of a sore trial or test, to go to God and to thank him for it, to see his love, to appreciate the fact that all things work together for good, as it says in Romans 8:28, so long as we love God. Don't forget about those many blessings. Don't forget about the many benefits that there are in God's family, observing God's laws. Psalm 103, verse 1, it says, Bless the Eternal, O my soul, and all that is within me. Bless his holy name. Bless the Lord, O my soul, and forget not all his benefits. Don't forget the many benefits that God has given to us. And this beautiful psalm, it goes through and it lists them all off. How blessed we are to just know and to understand the precious truth of God, to understand and to know the prophecies of God. It's a dark and negative world for sure. And some of these prophecies are, well, it's hard. It's hard to watch them. It's sad to see the world suffer, to see people in misery. But there is a solution to all the problems and troubles of this world. The solution, of course, is in the hope of the gospel message. The precious hope of the royal family of God, of God's royal law. And if you're coming along into God's work or more supportive of God's church than ever before, your mind is being opened to these precious, precious truths. Give God thanks for it. Don't commit one of the more common sins of all, the sin of ingratitude. Give thanks to God in everything. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Don't forget to email the program with feedback, td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us on today's program, and we'll see you tomorrow.